This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Solar World. We're about to speak again with Robert Lyden, who's the Executive Vice President and General Manager at Sterling Energy Systems in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome back to Solar World.
Good to be back, Mark.
We had an extensive and detailed conversation recently about contract signed between Southern California Edison and Sterling Energy Systems to install a 500-megawatt solar plant in the Mojave Desert. Give us just, for new listeners, just a very brief picture of what that agreement was about and what it means for your company and for SCE.
Sure. It's a power purchase agreement, which means that we will construct a solar power generating station in the Mojave Desert and generate power that we'll deliver to SCE under a contract for 20 years. Obviously, it's a solar contract, meaning that we'll be generating power that is largely oriented towards the peak demand for Southern California Edison. We generate more power. The hotter and brighter the sun is in the daytime, the more power we generate. So we really match the peak load of SCE pretty well. So it's a way of providing to SCE a significant amount of really valuable electrons, if you will. And for us, it's our first large-scale deployment of a technology that we've been developing since the company was founded in 1996.
Okay, and if you could briefly elucidate how the Sterling engines that you build convert incoming solar energy into outgoing electricity.
Sure. The Sterling engine is basically an external heat engine, meaning that there's, unlike your car engine that has a fuel that gets ignited and exploded inside the engine, in the case of a Stirling engine, heat is applied to a receiver head on the engine, and the receiver head has a lot of sealed gas in it. In our case, we use hydrogen gas. It's sealed. The hydrogen gas is not ignited. It's simply heated up. It expands and pushes pistons up and down. And the pistons are connected directly to a generator motor and generate AC power. So it's each individual dish generates enough electricity for somewhere between 6 and 10 homes, and it's 25 kilowatts, and it is its own independent generator. So our solar field of 500 megawatts is 20,000 dishes when it's finally built out.
Okay. Now, the question that occurred to me that we didn't discuss last time was, why not photovoltaics? It's always seemed to me that the breakthrough in using solar energy in an effective way would come through either some sort of mass purchase or some improved technology that used chips that essentially turn incoming photons into outgoing electrons. What's the comparison between your technology and photovoltaics, and why was this really big solar energy contract signed with a company that makes that uses Stirling engines and not silicon chips to create electricity from sun power?
Good question, Mark. The short answer is that the silicon chips do a very good job for remote applications. They generate small amounts per chip of power, and not kilowatts, but millivolts of electricity. It's AC power. It's a type of thing that could go to a battery system and provide, you know, backup for some sort of an off-grid generator system or whatever.
Like the kind of systems that power the highway phone boxes.
Yes, exactly. And they've also, of course, they've been developed and extensively marketed over the last decade or so, and are now seeing a lot of applications on rooftops of individual homes to provide a portion of the electricity needs for an individual housing. But if you want to do large-scale power generation for a company like SCE, you really want to go to a technology such as ours that concentrates the solar heat from the sun and can very efficiently convert that into AC power, which is what the grid system uses. So, and that's what our dish does. And we, in fact, hold the world's efficiency record for the conversion of solar energy into grid-delivered electricity.
Now, does this even work? What about using your mirrors to focus solar energy onto photovoltaic cells.
Well, that's a good thing. That is a technology that's being explored now. It's still very much in a R&D stage. Some of the big challenges there are that PV cells really operate better in relatively lower temperatures.
So you'd essentially melt them if you did what you're doing.
Well, that's right. Unless you took the heat off, had some sort of a very active heat rejection system to take the heat off. And that's one of the biggest challenges. And another one is the cost. The cost of the PV cells is substantially higher than the cost per kilowatt or per unit of electricity output for a four-cylinder engine.
Okay, and are there also issues involved with pollution, waste products caused by the manufacturing process for photovoltaic cells that really aren't there for building Stirling engines?
Well, that's true. Now, the PV industry folks would say, with the silicon-based cells, there's some byproduct chemicals, most of which are supposedly contained in the processing of the things at the factories. But if you go to some of the more advanced cells that use gallium arsenide and various other types of things, there you really work with some things that are very tricky and poisonous type of substances. And there is a lot of, basically to make a PV cell, and I'm not an expert on this, but it is a chemical process.
Right.
It's basically using a lot of solvents in order to make the silicon into a PV cell.
Right. And how much environmental pollution is there, either in the production, the manufacturing process for your engines, or in their operation?
Very, very little. We use a traditional manufacturing operation that they use for making automotive engines, which uses castings that have a lot of heat, but there's not a lot of other pollution coming out of the plant. And the engines and so on are made of steel and some other materials like high-temperature steel alloys. But they're really, and the dishes themselves are made of glass, mirrored glass, and again a steel frame. So it's a really very conventional type of materials that do not generate a lot of pollution in the process of fabricating them. They in the operation of the dish, there is no pollution. There's no output. We're not combusting any fuel, so we don't have any exhaust. We have lubricating oil that's sealed in the engine, just like on your car, but there's no spillage from that. There's no there's hydrogen gas that's sealed inside the engine, but even if some of that were to leak away, it immediately goes up into the upper atmosphere and is a very harmless thing to humans and so on. We produce no CO2, no other greenhouse gases and so on. So it's a very clean technology.
Okay. Now, there's some related questions related to each other that I want to raise, and I think the core question of that series is what's the smallest workable size that one of your machines can be built at? What size are they built at now, and how small could they be made? And you'll see in a second, of course, where this is going.
Right. I think I could see where the pathway is. It's right now we have two different size dishes. We have a 10-kilowatt dish, which would be producing enough power to supply somewhere around four homes or five homes. With their total energy needs. And we have a 25-kilowatt dish, which, as I said I think before, is somewhere 6 to 10 homes. And that's that larger dish is the one that we're using for this large-scale deployment. How small could they be made? There are Stirling engines around. Our company doesn't produce them, but that are in the 1 to 2-kilowatt range, which would be a nice size for an individual home use. However, if you use it with a solar dish, the dish still has to be larger than the satellite dish that you might have for your TV set.
You mean the little satellite dishes or the old big satellite dishes?
Well, it's even larger than the big ones. Not a lot larger than the big ones, but certainly much bigger than the little ones that are out today.
Right.
And so for residential applications, which is, I think, kind of where you're headed.
Right.
This dish drilling technology is not probably the right answer. PV cells, frankly, make a better better type of a neighbor for individual residence use.
Because there's a bill pending in the California legislature called 1 million solar roofs. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am, yes.
And it pretty much relates to photovoltaic installations.
Well, it does. It's almost exclusively for PVs, and certainly our dishes, either the 10 kilowatt dish or the 25 kilowatt dish, would be a fairly awkward apparatus to stick on the rooftop of some building.
Well, aesthetic and zoning considerations put to the side for a second, would it be practical to build one of these dishes that you've got, one per neighborhood, say, or on vacant lots near residential areas, or otherwise scatter them around instead of putting them all out in the desert? Or as a complement to the ones that are out there in the desert, would that make any sense from a technical point of view?
It certainly would. In fact, that's one of the things that when we started looking first at this technology, we thought was perhaps the primary application was for distributed energy generation. That is where you aren't hooking into a big grid system and delivering to the utility company, but rather supplying directly to a demand source, to a user.
Not to mention the vast numbers of parking lots that are sitting out here in Southern California in particular that have vast amounts of space where they could probably get some solar energy that would be coming up off the ground as well as out of the sky.
Well, the stuff off the ground probably wouldn't help very much, because you really need to concentrate the sun.
Right. Okay.
That's what those big dish.
But you see what I'm saying? With all the parking lots that are sitting out there, that
sure,
they could be built. And in fact, if people had electric hybrid cars that used electricity, they could be charging up while they're sitting there all day.
Well, it's an interesting application, and it is certainly one that we think has some potential future. You said putting aside the zoning and kind of neighbor aesthetic
right,
issues, that is unfortunately an issue that has to be dealt with, and that's going into individual neighborhoods is probably problematic.
Principally for those reasons.
This aesthetic reason, but
unless people took it into their mind to believe that those dish arrays are pretty attractive looking and that would enhance the visual focus of the neighborhood.
Well, I happen to believe that, but then
right,
I have a little bias, I suppose.
Right.
But that is kind of an issue that that we'd just as soon not be trying to fight as a sort of a first marketing effort. But I think it's something that, as people become more accustomed to this technology and so on, they're either going to decide that they really like it or maybe they'll decide they don't like it for aesthetic reasons or in their own backyard. But there are a lot of other distributed applications in areas like rural water pumping.
Right.
This type of thing, where this is a great technology for that.
Okay. And so specifically on the 1 million solar roofs bill, are Stirling engines or your products covered by that, or are you getting involved to maybe modify it so that they would be, or are you just leaving that alone and letting the photovoltaic people deal with it?
We participated in some of the review processes that led to the drafting of the current legislation, and frankly concluded that it was going to be very difficult to try to figure out how to change that legislation to specifically kind of fold in Stirling gensets as part of the program.
A genset is what?
A generating system.
Oh, right. Okay.
Set.
Right.
I'm sorry. So we've kind of said, well, we like our friends in the PV industry, and we don't want to sort of stomp on their parade.
Right.
But it is something that we think we can offer to the utilities and to the, frankly, to the taxpayers of California, a far more economical way of generating electricity and renewable clean electricity than putting lots of PV cells that are pretty expensive on rooftops. But we're not trying to diss our competitors on this thing. They've got a great product.
Right. So essentially, the 1 million solar roofs can go for PV, and you'll be out in the desert making electricity and sending it into town or something.
Yep, and we'll make a lot more electrons than they will with a million roofs.
Okay. You mentioned rural water pumping facilities that could be powered by the Stirling engines that you make. What generally is the worldwide demand for electricity, and what are the worldwide opportunities, especially in less developed countries where there isn't a power grid already of the substance that North America has?
Well, I'm not sure I'd give you the I should be able to, but I'm not sure I want to. I feel comfortable with citing a specific demand for gigawatt hours of electricity, but it is immense. There's a probably two-thirds of the world is either under-electrified or doesn't have electricity at all, doesn't have a grid system. So they're relying either on not having any electricity at all for their homes, or using some sort of a diesel generator or something like that. Very remote type of thing.
So, in fact, what we were talking about that it might not fit into the aesthetics of suburban America to put these on one lawn out of 10, but there are countries where there is no grid, and by plopping one of these down, either bringing it in by mule or helicopter, would create the possibility of generating electricity in far-flung locations.
No question about it. And we've, in fact, been doing some work with the largest utility in the African continent,
right.
ESKOM.
What's it called?
ESKOM, E-S-K-O-M.
Right.
And they have, in fact, one of our dishes in Johannesburg for kind of a research dish.
Right.
And the idea there was that we wanted to look at that very thing, at putting electrifying parts of the African continent that have no electricity right now, and even if it was just to power a schoolhouse,
right, or especially powering a schoolhouse,
right, so that we could bring the internet,
right,
to these schools that could remarkably improve the education systems, and a more educated world is likely to be a more peaceful world.
I was going to mention that, but I'm glad that you did. Essentially, a wireless internet technology works very synergistically with distributed Stirling engines to generate electricity to power the wireless units out there in rural areas.
That's right. And, there's also places, we don't have to go outside of our own nation here. We have Native American tribes in various places around the United States that have also problems with lack of electrical distribution systems. The Navajo Nation being perhaps the most noteworthy. There's a very large number, I think it's 25,000 homes or something in the Navajo Nation, have no electricity whatsoever.
They're right around the corner from you in Phoenix there, aren't they, pretty much?
They actually are. They occupy a big chunk of land up in the northern part of our state. I also go over into parts of New Mexico, a little bit of Colorado in there, and Utah, I believe.
Are there any initiatives underway from private or government sources to get some of your units out there into the Navajo country?
Well, there's no government initiatives that are specifically oriented towards that, although there are some things that were included in the energy bill that was just enacted into law a week ago or so, that do call for federal support for the development, for the electrification of Native American lands, and the development of new transmission systems that would serve not only within the nation, but also would take power that was generated by renewable sources on the Native American lands and deliver it outside the Native American
tribes. With money going back in exchange for the electricity.
Exactly. And we have discussions that have been ongoing with several Native American tribes, including the Navajos and the Hopis,
right,
in Arizona, with the idea of providing large-scale solar on their lands and selling it primarily outside to, among other people, Southern California Edison, but also to the Arizona utilities and to Nevada utilities.
Say a little bit about Southern California Edison, that's your partner in this. I've been watching their commercials with particular note since we talked, and they have some commercials stressing their commitment to renewables. They have some wind farms in the picture. Why Southern California Edison, and why now that a big utility has actually taken the leap here?
Well, SCE has been pretty progressive, in fact, quite progressive with regard to adopting renewable energy. They buy all of the electricity off of 354 megawatts of solar trough systems that are out in the Mojave Desert right now, and they, of course, have a lot of wind energy, and they've got, I think, about 18% of their total retail load comes from renewable sources right now. And so, and part of the impetus and part of the reason why now, why them, is that the state of California has mandate, a renewable portfolio standard that requires all the public utilities to, that is those that are controlled by the CPUC, which is, includes San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, and PG&E,
right,
that they must, by 2010 now, I believe, have 20% of their total power production coming from renewable resources.
Is that the most stringent or the strongest renewable policy in the country?
I believe it is. It's certainly a very, very progressive policy, and the legislature and the governors should be very much commended for really taking a very aggressive stand with regard to this. And it has been the impetus that's causing all of the utilities in California, including the municipally owned utilities, to become far more aggressive in their adoption of renewable energy.
Okay, now, there's another technical question that leads to another series of questions, and that has to do with the fungibility of electricity and the state of the North America, starting with the North American grid, in terms of whether electricity generated in one place can be effectively used somewhere else, or whether the transmission lines are incapable of doing it, or incapable of doing it without losing so much of the power in the transmission that it becomes pointless to do that. How integrated is electrical distribution in North America now?
Well, there's a remarkable degree of integration in many areas of the country, including much of the West. Texas is sort of isolated, has its own grid system, but and there's, as you've noticed from times past, where even the grid systems of Canada and so on are linked with the grid systems of the eastern U.S. And
because there are two forces that are involved, elements that I've noticed. Enron made a lot of money trading and selling energy, which must have meant it could be traded and sold. And I guess just recently there was a big power outage in the north central part of the country that was caused by cascading problems all around. So there obviously is an interconnection of all of these different power grids, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And for this reason, energy is a fungible product. It can be, in fact, traded from utility to utility or from state to state. There are some limitations to it. As you point out, there are losses in the grid system caused by resistance losses in the wires and by losses in the transformer systems as
right.
well. But and this is part of the reason why these large transmission grid systems have these very big, high voltage lines. That 500,000 volt lines and this type of thing, is the higher the voltage, the lower the amount of loss in the transmission.
Huh.
So you don't see a lot of 110 volt lines running around the country. You see high voltage things with transformers.
In other words, the percentage lost, or the percentage lost, is lower the higher the voltage.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so you get, and if you're traveling relatively short distances, I mean a few hundred miles or so, there's the grid losses can be minimized, can be pretty small and very tolerable. If, however, you're trying to transfer power from, say, California over to Bangor, Maine or something,
right?
Very few electrons would actually get to Bangor, Maine from California. They'd be lost someplace along that 3,000 or 4,000 mile path. By going to a high voltage direct current line, which there are a few around the country now, you can actually transmit power much longer distances than with alternating currents.
So using direct current, is that a more more recent development to do those direct current lines?
Well, I think the development of high voltage direct current lines is a relatively recent development in the transmission world, but DC power has been around for as long as AC power has been around,
right.
I think.
But you're saying there is a technical way to send electricity long distances efficiently.
Yes, there is. There are not very many high voltage DC lines actually existing now, and they're all privately owned and dedicated.
Right.
But it is possible to take power from, say, Wyoming and bring it into California with very little loss.
Okay. Now, as you see where, I'm sure you see where this is going also, because the last time we spoke, we talked about what percentage of the incident solar radiation in the Mojave Desert was going to be taken advantage of by this installation that you're building for SCE.
Right.
The question is whether you could cover a wider area of the Mojave Desert and generate more electricity, even more than California needs, and export it to Wyoming or Bangor, Maine, or the Southeast.
Absolutely. And there is some statistics from the Department of Energy that say that if you were to take an area about 100 miles by 100 miles, that's a lot of area, but it's only a fraction of the Mojave Desert.
Right.
You could generate enough power to replace all of the fossil fuel demand for energy in the entire United States. That includes for transportation uses as well as for electrical lighting and electrical industrial uses.
Okay, and we're talking in that case just about California. I imagine that there are other deserts in other parts of the world that aren't being used very much for anything now, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, of course. And you can go to virtually each continent, and you'll find some desert areas. There's desert areas in Australia. There's obviously in Africa and China and that part of Asia, and of course, here in the southwestern United States and in South America and in Mexico. There's lots of desert areas around that are not very good for people to live in because it's hot and very arid and not very hospitable.
But every one of those characteristics that make it inhospitable for people makes it an ideal site for more Stirling engines, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a great place for Stirling engines, and you know the world is really just made up of lots of places that are ideal homes for Stirling Stirling solar systems.
So it sounds like that the technical capability and the sort of geo meteorological conditions exist to deploy enough of these units to generate enough electricity to take the whole world off of fossil fuels and lead to the economic development of a lot of underdeveloped areas.
Exactly. And that's of course, would be kind of, a dream of any of us that work in this type of industry, is that we could move at least a good ways in that direction. There's, if you were really going to try to transmit power from, say, the Mojave Desert back to Bangor, Maine,
right,
you would probably find it more efficient to take and convert the electricity, use electricity to make hydrogen from water, and then actually pipeline the hydrogen back east.
It's okay.
A more efficient transportation system, and the hydrogen just acts as a storage for the electricity.
Okay, well, talk about that a little. And we only talked about the Stirling engine generation of electricity from your company, but you're a more broadly based renewable energy company, aren't you?
Well, we are.
Talk about some of the other technologies that you're involved with.
Well, we're doing some research on using actually solar systems to for high temperature electrolysis conversion of water into hydrogen, and so for long term, we think 20 years out, maybe 10 years out, this will become a very viable thing, both for transportation uses in fuel cells or internal combustion engines, but also for replacing fossil fuels and power plants.
So you're saying essentially out there in the Gobi or Sahara or Mojave Desert, you can turn the solar energy into electricity and then use that or just use the high temperature, you use the electricity to electrolyze water and generate hydrogen, which stores energy, which can then be shipped through pipelines to any place it needs to go and into remote areas that don't have the pipeline by tanker, and therefore distribute the energy that's ultimately solar-powered on a wider basis.
Exactly, and we could do that. Now you could either, you make the electricity and then, use the traditional transmission lines and so on to take the electricity closer to, say, a seaport area,
right,
where there's a lot of water, and then use desalinated water to make the to provide the source for the hydrogen.
Could you also use that electricity while you're making the hydrogen? Could you desalinate some of the water and keep it as water? Because water seems to be a scarce resource. A desalinated water is a scarce resource also for agriculture and bathing and lawns and drinking.
Oh, absolutely. There are several different ways in which you can desalinate water, but certainly one of the approaches is to use just heat and use a distillation type of a process, or that combined with a filtration process, both of which are fairly energy intensive, and so they require a fair amount of electricity to drive the actual electrolysis or the desalination process.
What happens if you electrolyze seawater, create hydrogen and oxygen, and then reformulate the water out of the hydrogen and oxygen? Do you get drinkable water then?
You would. Certainly in theory you do. The only problem with that is that all of the minerals, including the salt and
right,
the iodine and so on that's in the seawater, kind of foul up a lot of the electrolysis process after a period of time.
Okay,
So it's probably better to actually go through a two-step process, the first cleaning up the water and then electrolyzing it.
And then you could either use it for human purposes or to create hydrogen.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Speaking of water, there was a program on California, a segment on California Connected about a week ago that showed something called the Sea Dog Project. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not.
But it was an idea of turning a wave power into usable energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved putting a construction out a few miles into the ocean, and the big waves, before they break, but while they're out there in the ocean, that rise and fall, were used to lift and then to lift essentially a piston in a that would go up, and then it would fall down as the wave went down. It would go up and down, and it inevitably reminded me of the diagrams that I had been looking at for the Stirling engine, which turns up and down motion of a piston into electricity.
Right.
And the Sea Dog technology apparently uses the up and down motion to pump water uphill, and then it's allowed to fall downhill back into the ocean and drive a turbine that way. But I was wondering whether, and I can probably get you some more information about it, whether the up and down motion of the waves moving this piston up and down could in some way be converted as electricity is generated from the Stirling engine to use that that natural energy to also generate electricity.
Well, there's a lot of fascinating technologies that all, such as this, what you're describing, which I'd read about but hadn't heard under the name of Sea Dog. But
right.
But there's a lot of different ways that you can use the various sources of energy that we have in very plentiful supply, all renewable type of energy. That would all help us to solve this problem of our filching in our own nest, basically,
right,
of using fossil fuels and so on to create pollution while we burn up precious and non-renewable resources.
That we could have used to make vinyl records if we still made vinyl records.
Or we could use it for a lot of other purposes.
Right.
We're not, incidentally, our company, nor philosophically, are we against oil companies or as things? We think that there's clearly a place. There are many things in this world that are not replaced by anything other than oil. So we clearly need to use those resources. We just like to see these companies take a broader definition of what they are. They're an energy company, and that they really ought to be using the oil for other purposes besides providing electricity or providing the fuel for an automobile, and looking to other of these resources, such as the ones you're referring to, for clean energy that would fuel our planet. We have you mentioned wave power or the power from tidal currents and so on. Really, in a way, that's also is a a form of solar energy, as is wind energy for that matter.
Is wave motion come from solar heating of the differential heating?
Well, part of it comes from the
the moon and the rotation of the Earth.
But you also create a lot of the storms, which create that create the waves and create a lot of the turbulence around the things, come obviously from weather-related things that are due to the solar activity.
And in fact, all the fossil fuels are in a sense solar energy, because they're trapped. They're the fermented products of the trapped vegetation and animal life that was fueled by the sun millions of years ago.
Yep.
So it's simply a question of whether to use the leftover energy or take advantage of the constantly influx solar energy that generated it in the first place and could be put to work now that we're more highly evolved directly without having to wait millions of years.
Exactly. It's all a matter of how we decide to use our solar energy, I guess.
Okay, good. Well, I want to thank you for building some machines that help us do that and for talking to us and explaining everything to our listeners. And I look forward to talking to you some more. What is the timetable for the deployment of the system out in the Mojave Desert that you're building for SCE?
Because of these needs to construct new transmission lines, something we talked about earlier,
right,
and so on, we're looking at probably starting the deployment of the 500 megawatts in 2008.
Right.
It'll take about a four-year period to construct it all.
So you'll be constructing the power lines and the dishes at the same time?
Well, we have to put the power lines in before we can actually start delivering power out of the dishes. So
right.
The transmission lines come first, and then we'll start building and putting onto the grid on a progressive basis every day, putting some more power onto the grid until we kind of grow the entire plant out to its full size.
And whose responsibility is it to build the transmission lines?
Well, they'll be built by SCE, and they are transmission lines that will be owned by them, but and in fact, they're upgrades from existing lines that are owned by Southern California Edison.
Okay, and so we can, in about 3 years, we can, I'll be able to, I don't live in an SCE area, but if I move, I'll be able to use that solar power in about 3 years, you're saying?
Yep, should be able to.
All right, good. Thanks very much, and let's talk again as the process continues.
Okay, very good. Nice to talk to you, Mark.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye.